Part 4. 17. Hand Grenade Diplomacy. On June 9, 2018, President Trump was at his second day of meetings at the Group of Seven summit, hosted in Quebec by Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. This was an annual gathering of leaders from seven of the world's industrial powers: Canada, France, Germany, Italy, Japan, the United Kingdom, and the United States. It had been an unusually acrimonious summit. European allies, including German Chancellor Angela Merkel, French President Emmanuel Macron, and British Prime Minister Theresa May, were pressing Trump to sign a joint statement committing to a rules-based international order. The president had resisted, believing his counterparts were ganging up on him, before eventually relenting. Then Trump put his hand in his suit pocket, took two Starburst candies out, threw them on the table in front of Merkel, and said, "Here, Angela, don't say I never gave you anything." According to Ian Bremmer, president of the Eurasia Group. Traditionally, the G7 has been a forum for the United States and its allies to express common democratic principles and fortify economic partnerships and aspirations. In the recent past, the annual summits had amounted to carefully scripted shows of unity against authoritarian adversaries, including Russia, which had been a member, it was then the Group of Eight, until it was kicked out in 2014 following the annexation of Crimea. But over 2 days in Quebec, Trump effectively blew up the G7. He abruptly withdrew the U.S. endorsement of a joint declaration of unity, which his own representatives had already agreed to, and upbraided Trudeau on Twitter as very dishonest and weak because the prime minister objected to Trump's tariffs on steel and aluminum imports from Canada and other nations. Then he stormed out of Quebec. Just before departing Canada, Trump threatened a trade war with any country, including allies. "We're like the piggy bank that everybody is robbing, and that ends," he said. Trump's complaint in Quebec drove to the core of his campaign pitch to the forgotten men and women of America, that he would forcefully put U.S. interests first by renegotiating trade deals to restrict foreign imports and increase U.S. exports. But according to many economists, blocking foreign imports would have been counterproductive and actually harmful to the U.S. economy. Trump headed directly to Singapore, the island nation in the Pacific, where history awaited him. He was set to meet Kim Jong-un for the first ever face-to-face talks between an American president and a North Korean leader. On the way, one of Trump's top advisors revealed that the tantrum the president threw in Quebec might have been about more than just trade disagreements. POTUS is not going to let a Canadian prime minister push him around, Larry Kudlow, director of the National Economic Council, said June 10th on CNN. He is not going to permit any show of weakness on the trip to negotiate with North Korea, nor should he. "So this was about North Korea?" anchor Jake Tapper asked. "Of course it was, in large part," Kudlow responded. The president envisioned the historic disarmament summit as the ultimate Donald J. Trump production. He thought meeting with Kim might even earn him the Nobel Peace Prize. Trump had long ago started imagining the pageantry. Earlier in the year, when he and Kim were first cooking up plans to meet, the White House Communications Agency had manufactured red, white, and blue challenge coins embossed with Trump's silver visage facing off against Kim. Just before leaving for Singapore on June 9th, Trump announced that he would be able to determine whether a denuclearization deal was attainable within the first minute of meeting Kim. "How? My touch, my feel, that's what I do," he boasted to reporters. One longtime Trump advisor summed up the president's mindset about the North Korea talks. "He looks at it like he looks at everything, which is, this is another guy who is the mouse that roared, who's tied his tail to China, to whom Donald Trump could be the messiah. Why? Because in Donald J. Trump's mind, he thinks that he, the president, has the ability to figure out a way to give Kim what he wants and to get what he wants. It's just another deal to him. The president, this advisor added, had thought to himself, am I intellectually as smart as Jimmy Carter? No, but I don't need to be. Do I have the vast reservoir of political cachet that the Bushes have? No, but I don't need that. What do I have? I can go one-on-one playing tennis. I don't need to play chess. I don't need long-range strategic diplomacy. On June 10th, when Trump arrived in Singapore, approximately 36 hours ahead of his meeting with Kim, it was so humid that visitors' shirts stuck to their backs the minute they stepped outdoors. About 5 hours earlier, Kim had landed aboard a Boeing 747 borrowed from the Chinese government. Trump was restless. He never liked life outside the bubble of his daily life, his bed, his televisions, his steaks and burgers. The antsy president told his aides to move up the start of the summit, scheduled for June 12th, to June 11th. He wanted to see Kim right away. We're here now, Trump told them. Why can't we just do it? After weeks of careful diplomatic negotiations by the U.S. and North Korean governments to choreograph the summit, Trump caused a flurry of commotion. His aides, including Secretary of State Mike Pompeo, John Kelly, and Bolton, pleaded against changing the schedule. They told him he needed the extra day to prepare for his talks with Kim. Plus, on June 11th, Trump was slated to meet with the Prime Minister of Singapore, a perfunctory visit that, if canceled, would insult the host government. Then Press Secretary Sarah Sanders made the argument that proved persuasive. If he moved the summit up to June 11th, a Monday, then it would air live on Sunday night in the United States, because Singapore is 12 hours ahead of Washington. Sir, you're doing a historic meeting and you don't want it on primetime? Sanders asked Trump. Of course he did. When Trump first met Kim at the lush Capella Hotel on the resort island of Sentosa, he shook the dictator's hand for 13 seconds, patted him on the back, and led him down a rich red carpet. Kim was a pariah, arguably the world's greatest abuser of human rights and committed to nuclear armament. But Trump threw Kim a party, showering him with respect and declaring himself honored to be in his presence. The summit was carefully staged to put both leaders on equal footing, which normalized the authoritarian Kim. The spectacle was so jarring that even Kim acknowledged the oddity. He was overheard telling Trump, through an interpreter, many people will think of this as a form of fantasy, a science fiction movie. Trump's nearly 9-hour day with Kim epitomized the president's reality show diplomacy. The summit was short on substance, but heavy on superlatives. Trump called Kim very talented, very smart, and a very good negotiator. He said the North Korean people were very gifted, and their country's future very, very bright. And he claimed personal credit for staving off a North Korean nuclear attack on Seoul, the South Korean capital, which is just 35 miles from the border and home to about 10 million people. This is really an honor for me to be doing this because I think, you know, potentially you could have lost, you know, 30, 40, 50 million people, Trump said. Trump began his grand finale news conference in Singapore by playing a film he had commissioned. First a version in Korean, and then one in English. It was startlingly reminiscent of Pyongyang's propaganda videos. The movie portrayed North Korea as some kind of paradise, with gleaming high-rises, time-lapsed sunrises, high-speed trains, majestic horses running through water, and children merrily skipping through a city square. It included a montage of images of Kim and Trump waving their hands and flashing thumbs up as if running mates in a campaign. Journalists were flabbergasted. Trump explained that he had it made to show Kim what his country's future would look like if it abandoned its nuclear weapons and normalized relations with the West. The shores of North Korea could be an exclusive resort destination. Trump said he played the video personally for Kim on an iPad, and yes, the North Korean dictator liked it. "They have great beaches," Trump told reporters. "You see that whenever they're exploding their cannons into the ocean, right? I said, 'Boy, look at that place. Wouldn't that make a great condo?' And I explained it. I said, instead of doing that, you could have the best hotels in the world right there. Think of it from a real estate perspective." The summit put a pause on bellicose rhetoric and threats of war, but produced nothing concrete. Certainly not a commitment from Kim to give up his nuclear arsenal. In the days following his Singapore trip, Trump spoke with apparent envy of Kim's rule. He admired how the North Korean people sit up at attention when their dictator spoke, and marveled at how tough Kim's guards appeared. After watching clips from North Korean state television, Trump noted the female news anchor's sycophancy and joked that she was even more lavish in her praise of the dear leader than Fox News hosts were of Trump. Elliot A. Cohen, a neoconservative who served as a top State Department official in the George W. Bush administration and was a critic of Trump's candidacy, said in the aftermath that the Singapore summit was just the latest manifestation of Trump's authoritarianism. "He has classic traits of the authoritarian leader. The one that's always struck me most is this visceral instinct of people's weaknesses and a corresponding desire to be seen as strong and respected and admired," Cohen said. He added, "We've been very fortunate that the institutions have contained him." Trump's courtship and flattery of Kim also laid bare Bolton's limits and his capacity to influence the administration. For years, Bolton had advocated a hardline position with North Korea. During the George W. Bush administration, he called Kim's father, Kim Jong-il, a tyrannical dictator, to which the North Korean leader responded by calling Bolton rude human scum. In February 2018, just before joining the Trump administration, Bolton had opined that the threat from Pyongyang was imminent and that the United States should launch a preemptive military strike as opposed to negotiating. Bolton was regarded not only for his ideology, but also for his masterful, if sharp-elbowed, manipulation of the federal bureaucracy and disciplined focus. The chaos of the Trump White House gave him the opportunity to seize control of the foreign policy process. Whereas H.R. McMaster ran the National Security Council by hewing to precedent, which included producing reports and leading regular meetings of principals or deputies to surface and vet policy recommendations from subject matter experts throughout the government, Bolton consolidated power within his personal office of loyalists and ideologues. He stopped holding all but the most essential NSC meetings and made clear to career staffers that he had no use for them. When NSC staff visited his office suite to confer with Bolton's assistant about a scheduling matter or upcoming meeting, Bolton would sometimes emerge from his office with a frown that seemed to ask, "Why are you here?" Bolton saw his job as being Trump's whisperer, carving out one-on-one time with the president to shape his policy views personally, as opposed to serving as an impartial broker who synthesized ideas and information from the vast array of federal departments and agencies. Bolton's doctrinaire views alarmed some Western allies, but Trump liked having him around. In bilateral meetings with foreign leaders, Trump developed a habit of teasing Bolton for his warmongering instincts. The president would often say a variation of this,
I've got hawks and I've got doves. Bolton will just bomb you. He'll turn your country into a parking lot. That's just how he is.
Gérard Araud, the French ambassador, recalled a senior White House official explaining to him that Trump can't stand people who try to moderate him, but he loves people who are stronger or harsher than he is. He loves to be the moderator in the building. So, compared to Bolton, he knows that Bolton wants to bomb anything. To Bolton, any problem can be solved by bombing, so he gets to be the voice of reason. Bolton kept to an unusually strict daily regimen. He woke up well before dawn and was in the office by about 5:30 or 6 in the morning, giving him 5 or more solid hours to work before Trump showed up in the Oval Office. Bolton typically left the White House around 4 in the afternoon and went to sleep early, telling aides not to bother him after 8:30 at night. He bordered on anal retentive, once scolding an aide who handed him a ream of documents for not placing the paperclips in precisely the right place. Some longtime national security officials saw Bolton as a self-aggrandizing and untrustworthy recluse, calling him Lone Wolf because he would spend hours each day burrowed in his office on the first floor of the West Wing, reading with the door shut. Colleagues knew not to disturb him. Articulating the difference between McMaster's and Bolton's style, one government official said that with Bolton, there's an underlying bias. He's selling when he's talking. One man is being more objective. One man's tone smells of deeper motivation. Acting as the arbiter of what Trump needed to know was made infinitely easier for Bolton by the president's impatience for national security or intelligence briefings and disinclination to study complicated issues. In the third week of June 2018, Secretary of Homeland Security Kirstjen Nielsen was aboard a government jet returning from giving a speech when she received a call from Sanders. The White House press secretary wanted Nielsen's help selling the administration's zero-tolerance immigration policy to reporters. "Can you come over and give the briefing on this?" Sanders asked. Sanders's reasons were obvious. She and her colleagues were getting slammed with questions from journalists about why migrant children were being separated from their parents while crossing the border over the last several days. The situation was fast becoming a humanitarian crisis. John Kelly had opposed the policy when immigration officials first proposed it in March 2017, and he was the Homeland Security Secretary. "No way, not on my watch," he told his team. Kelly had held them off for many months, including after he was named White House Chief of Staff. Once Nielsen took over at the Department of Homeland Security in December 2017, Immigration and Customs Enforcement Acting Director Thomas Homan and Customs and Border Protection Commissioner Kevin McAleenan had pitched her hard on the idea of family separations. Nielsen wasn't sure the policy would actually deter crossings or that the government had the capacity to separate families safely. But Trump loved the policy, as did some of his advisors, including Stephen Miller. They believed it might finally slow illegal migration. Another agency with a piece of the nation's immigration policy was the Department of Justice, where Attorney General Jeff Sessions was often looking for ways to repair his relationship with Trump. On April 6th, Sessions had announced the zero-tolerance policy for prosecuting every immigrant who crossed the border illegally. It had been the existing law, but this was a hardline interpretation, and it would require the government to separate adults from their children while they face charges. The Attorney General's announcement had caught other leaders in the government by surprise. He had not briefed the other agencies that would be responsible for implementing the policy, including the Departments of Homeland Security and Health and Human Services. Even Kelly had been caught off guard. By mid-June, the family separations had become a heart-wrenching global news story. At the White House,
Sanders and her team were stuck having to answer for zero tolerance, and they didn't know well the ins and outs of immigration enforcement. The communications team didn't want to put Sessions in charge of defending the policy. The man who had christened it with his no-warning announcement was someone Trump considered a weak performer on television. Everyone thought Sessions was incapable of selling this in any way, one senior administration official recalled. It was completely scatterbrained. So the White House turned to Nielsen, 46, a disciplined lawyer with a calm demeanor, as the best choice to explain and defend why children were being temporarily held while their parents were prosecuted for crossing the border illegally. Nielsen agreed she would do it, but it would have to be the following day, once she got back to Washington. Those closest to her urged her not to hold the briefing, including her deputy, Chad Wolf, and her chief of staff, Miles Taylor. Kelly was the firmest. If Nielsen did this, he warned, she'd become the face of the policy, which she had already cautioned would be tough to implement and which Sessions had enacted anyway. On June 18th, Nielsen stepped to the lectern at the White House press briefing room. The policy had been rolled out with little planning. Immigrants didn't realize that if they came into standard entry points along the U.S. border, they could file for asylum and wouldn't be prosecuted. Most didn't know that they would be prosecuted for crossing the border illegally, by crossing deserts or riverbanks, and then have their children temporarily taken away from them. And in the United States, the public didn't realize that to prosecute undocumented adults, the government was legally required to separate the children from their parents. By this point, the Department of Homeland Security had separated an estimated 2,300 children from their parents since the zero-tolerance policy began in April. The policy wasn't designed to separate kids in Nielsen's mind, but it didn't matter. Family separations were the result of deciding to prosecute the parents. Nielsen didn't know how bad the situation really was, and as she stood before the cameras, she didn't realize ProPublica, an investigative news organization, had just moments earlier posted an audio clip of migrant children, ages 4 to 10, crying and pleading to see their mothers and fathers while being corralled inside a Customs and Border Protection facility. Their misery had been recorded a week earlier by a Good Samaritan who preferred to remain anonymous but felt wrenched by their cries just hours after the children were separated from their parents. As Nielsen answered questions from reporters, Olivia Nuzzi of New York Magazine played the recording aloud in the briefing room. In addition to the sounds of sniffling and cries of Mommy and Poppy, a 6-year-old Salvadoran girl could be heard pleading to have someone call her aunt and repeating over and over the numbers she had memorized. A Customs and Border Protection agent could be heard joking in a deep voice, "Well, we've got an orchestra here." A reporter shouted out to Nielsen, "How is this not child abuse?" Nielsen felt blindsided, but she was also wary of assuming that the sounds of crying children automatically meant there had been some government failure and fearful of attacking her own department's employees without the full set of facts. Some claims of abuses by border agents had been exaggerated in the past. Her response was that of a careful lawyer, though she sounded callous. "Be more specific, please," she said. The tapes brought visceral proof of the warning from the American Academy of Pediatrics that such separations can cause children irreparable harm. When asked for her reaction to the tapes, Nielsen said coolly, "They reflect the focus of those who post such pictures and narratives." In her head, Nielsen was furious. All the warnings she had given her own agency heads about the difficulty of carefully separating children from parents were proving true. After giving the White House briefing, she became the public face of a government placing kids in cages. "She should have never gone to the fucking podium," one senior government official said. "I wish she had explained everything. We needed another 6 months to do it properly. We should have spent months telling migrants, if you're with a kid, please, please, come to a point of entry and you won't be separated." The problems at the border only worsened. Agents were overwhelmed. Children were being held longer than expected in makeshift shelters that resembled giant chicken coops. Information wasn't flowing quickly back to Washington because immigration and customs enforcement leaders, who had been gung-ho to deter illegal border crossings by punitively breaking up families, were not reporting significant hiccups quickly enough to Nielsen. As a result, the secretary looked as if she were out of touch. In the 2 days following her briefing, Nielsen and White House officials intensely debated whether to reverse course and halt the zero-tolerance enforcement. They all feared pissing off Trump, but other advisors had been quietly lobbying the president, including Ivanka Trump, who told her father that no deterrence policy was worth making the administration appear so cruel. The president broke first. On the morning of June 20th, he called Nielsen at home to say they had to fix what had become a public relations disaster. His conflicting instructions left her scratching her head. Yeah, we gotta fix this. Just stop it, Trump told Nielsen, referring to family separations. But I want zero tolerance to continue. Nielsen called Taylor to explain her predicament. The president's two directions were in clear conflict. I don't know what the fuck we are supposed to do, she said. An executive order was the only way to sort it out. Nielsen and her team, Miller and lawyers from the White House counsel's office, debated the wording of the order the president would need to sign to stop Sessions' policy. They considered pausing zero-tolerance prosecutions for anyone who entered the country illegally with a child, but then feared that would encourage child traffickers. They agreed on an order that would pause zero-tolerance for families illegally crossing the border. So, we're going to have strong, very strong borders, but we're going to keep the families together, Trump said while signing the order. I didn't like the sight or the feeling of families being separated. Nielsen stood behind the president, smiling, thinking she now knew her instructions and the law of the land was clear. But at this exact moment, the White House distributed information showing the president had signed a different order from the one Nielsen thought they had agreed to. It said the United States would stop family separations but continue zero tolerance. She learned the truth only when she returned to her office. Nielsen would later figure out how to interpret and execute the order with administration lawyers. It's absurdity on top of absurdity with this administration, the senior official recalled. On July 11th, Trump arrived in Brussels for the biannual NATO summit and complained immediately about an alliance he believed was taking advantage of the United States. The visit would become a transatlantic brawl. Sitting for what was billed as a perfunctory breakfast with NATO Secretary General Jens Stoltenberg, Trump accused many countries of being delinquent because they were not allocating enough money toward their own defense budgets. Trump then attacked Germany, whose longtime leader, Merkel, was respected as a consensus builder within NATO, as totally controlled by Russia because of an oil and gas deal between the two countries. This was a blatant attack on Merkel, who grew up in East Germany when it was actually controlled by the Soviet Union, and who had worked since the end of the Cold War to promote democratic values in unified Germany. As Trump made his case, members of the U.S. delegation were visibly stricken. This set the tone for an acrimonious NATO summit, a repeat of Quebec. The next day, July 12th, the situation went from uncomfortable to dangerous. The NATO summit was concluding as planned. European leaders were pleased that Trump had been reasonably well-behaved, despite the visceral disdain he had long harbored for them because he believed they looked down on him. But late in the morning, Trump arrived at NATO headquarters and was visibly fuming. He was frustrated that news reports of his first day in Brussels did not describe him as angry enough. In Trump's mind, the stories failed to convey to people back home the depth of his agitation with allies for failing to up the ante on defense spending. Several U.S. officials could tell the president was in a foul mood just by watching him enter the main atrium of the NATO headquarters from the windowed offices on a balcony above. He was about 45 minutes late. Though his Secret Service detail entered the building with him, Trump looked very much like a man alone. The president was frowning, his head was down, and he made no effort to look up to greet anyone or say hello. He was walking toward the main NATO meeting hall with purpose. Trump arrived at the meeting of the North Atlantic Council, where members were already deep into a conference with the presidents of Ukraine and Georgia, and took it over without so much as a courtesy greeting. Holding the meeting hostage, Trump scolded and shamed countries one by one for their defense spending totals. He was on a tear. He harassed individual leaders. He had statistics at the ready, indicating his assault was pre-planned. He warned that if NATO member nations did not meet their defense spending targets of 2% of their gross domestic product by January, the United States might leave the alliance. Trump had trouble putting his precise threat into words. First, he warned there would be grave consequences if the Allies didn't draw up formal commitments to increase their defense spending amounts. Then he said the United States would go our own way. Stunned by Trump's tirade, Stoltenberg tried to calm the room, but the president snapped. "No, we are not playing this game," Trump said. "Other presidents have done this, but I'm not going to." The entire Western alliance scrambled for an hour to keep itself together in the face of the possibility that the United States could withdraw from NATO, which it helped found in 1949 to counter the Soviet Union. Just 10 minutes later, Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis's aides began getting urgent texts on their phones. They were desperately needed in the U.S. holding room. As Dana White, Mattis's press secretary, rushed downstairs, she saw Hogan Gidley, a deputy White House press secretary, and shared what she considered a terrifying development. "I'm getting messages that we're pulling out of NATO," she said. Gidley, who had a self-effacing, aw shucks manner, counseled in his southern drawl that nobody rushed to judgment. He'd been here before. "Some of Trump's ideas sound ominous," he explained, "but may not end the world." "You know the president likes to float things," Gidley said, "but it's just a floater." Katie Wheelberger, a former aide to Vice President Cheney, who was acting Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Affairs and who didn't rattle easily, had a panicky look on her face after witnessing the president harangue his fellow NATO partners. "It feels like we just pulled out of NATO," Wheelberger said. Stoltenberg himself called an emergency session for allies, only so they could discuss Trump's demands on expenditures and construct a response on their burden-sharing agreements. Mattis, a steadfast NATO supporter, had had to miss the emergency session to attend a prearranged meeting with a battlefield commander who had flown from the Middle East to Brussels strictly to brief him. The fact that the defense secretary wasn't attached to Trump's shoulder at this particular moment made Pentagon officials nervous. Who, then, could prevent Trump from doing something catastrophic? Kelly soon located and retrieved Mattis for a huddle about what they should do. The defense secretary suggested he, Kelly, Bolton, and Pompeo meet privately with Trump in a secure holding room. Aides said they heard Trump wanted to hold an immediate press conference, but Mattis wanted to talk to the boss first. After Mattis and the others spoke with Trump, the president emerged first from their private conference. Miller, a fellow NATO skeptic, was busy drafting some talking points for the impromptu news conference. Mattis and Kelly hung back, continuing their private discussion. The Pentagon reporters who traveled with Mattis and had already been screened by security officials were waiting on the secretary's plane to depart Brussels with him. Now they were furious upon finding out they would be missing a major Trump news conference that Mattis was attending. Before heading to the airport to depart Brussels, Trump addressed throngs of journalists from around the world at a lectern at NATO headquarters. The American president made claims that some of his international counterparts contested. For instance, Macron and other foreign leaders disputed Trump's announcement that countries had agreed to eventually increase their spending quite a bit higher than 2% of their gross domestic product. However, the U.S. officials traveling with Trump breathed a major sigh of relief when Trump stated, "I believe in NATO." He called the alliance a fine-tuned machine and praised its great unity, great spirit, great esprit de corps. At his news conference, Trump revealed he had been disappointed with the media's lack of coverage of him scolding the Europeans to pay more. "I was surprised that you didn't pick it up. It took until today," he said, as if his morning threat were a stunt orchestrated to generate headlines. Javier Bettel, the prime minister of Luxembourg, had reminded reporters that Trump had wireless internet on Air Force One and could reverse his support for NATO in a single tweet once he left Brussels. When a reporter asked Trump if he might attack NATO on Twitter after departing, just as he had maligned Trudeau following the G7 in Quebec, the president replied, "No, that's other people that do that. I don't. I'm very consistent. I'm a very stable genius." 4 days later, Trump warmly embraced Russia, NATO's greatest direct threat. The Trump-Putin summit in Helsinki was long in the making. Trump was under intense pressure to confront Putin over his broad subterfuge operation in the 2016 election, as well as to counter Russia's intervention in Syria and Ukraine. Trump knew before he clasped Putin's hand that U.S. investigators had built an airtight case proving the Russian government had interfered in the election. When Trump had announced at the end of June his scheduled Helsinki summit for mid-July, Mueller's prosecutors had been getting their ducks in a row to indict a dozen GRU military officers for the email hacks. They faced a diplomatic quandary. They had to give Trump a heads up and offer to let him decide whether he wanted the indictment to occur before or after he met with Putin. Trump's choice surprised the prosecutors. He wanted the announcement of the indictment to take place prior to the Helsinki summit. Before leaving Washington, Trump sat down with Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein to preview the Justice Department's charges against 12 Russian intelligence officers for hacking Democratic emails. The indictment, which Rosenstein publicly announced on July 13th, was a major development in Robert Mueller's investigation. "When we confront foreign interference in American elections, it is important for us to avoid thinking politically as Republicans or Democrats, and instead to think patriotically as Americans," Rosenstein said, announcing the indictment. The blame for election interference belongs to the criminals who committed election interference. We need to work together to hold the perpetrators accountable. Trump, however, was not interested in holding the Russians accountable. He was focused on forging a better friendship with Putin during their tête-à-tête in Helsinki. "He's not my enemy, and hopefully someday maybe he'll be a friend. It could happen," Trump said. When a Washington Post reporter asked him if he intended to confront Putin on election interference, Trump mocked the very suggestion, "Your favorite question about meddling," and said he expected Putin to deny it yet again. Earlier, when the CBS anchor Jeff Glor asked Trump during a one-on-one interview whether he would ask Putin to extradite the 12 indicted Russian agents, Trump replied that he hadn't thought of doing so. On July 16th, Trump and Putin spent 2 hours meeting alone, joined only by their interpreters, inside Finland's neoclassical presidential palace along Helsinki's glistening waterfront. Unlike in most foreign leader meetings, there was no note-taker to compile an official record of what was said or what promises were made. What came next was historically unprecedented. As he held forth with Putin for a 46-minute joint news conference, Trump refused to endorse the conclusion of U.S. intelligence agencies that the Russian government had tried to sabotage the U.S. election to help him win. In fact, he said he took the word of Putin over the collective assessment of his own intelligence agencies. Trump demurred when Jonathan Lemire of the Associated Press asked, "Would you now, with the whole world watching, tell President Putin, would you denounce what happened in 2016? And would you warn him to never do it again?" "All I can do is ask the question," Trump replied. Referring to his director of national intelligence, the president continued, "My people came to me. Dan Coats came to me and some others and said they think it's Russia. I have President Putin. He just said it's not Russia. I will say this. I don't see any reason why it would be." Trump then raised a series of questions about Hillary Clinton's emails before adding, "I have great confidence in my intelligence people, but I will tell you that President Putin was extremely strong and powerful in his denial today." Inside Mueller's office, the prosecutors investigating Russian election interference watched the televised coverage with a mixture of concern and grim resignation. Intelligence operators had determined Putin had ordered the interference. The prosecutors also knew Trump had repeatedly been provided evidence of it. Trump's performance in Helsinki sparked horror among the national security establishment in Washington. He thought he had come across as strong, but an hour into his flight home, Trump's mood darkened as he watched cable news on a satellite feed and was shown printouts of statements from fellow Republicans condemning his comments. Even for some of the president's Republican allies, Helsinki was an out-of-body experience. Coates effectively rebuked his boss, saying that the intelligence assessment of Russia's ongoing pervasive efforts to undermine our democracy was clear and had been presented to Trump in an unvarnished fashion. Senator John McCain did not mince words in his statement. "Today's press conference in Helsinki was one of the most disgraceful performances by an American president in memory. The damage inflicted by President Trump's naivete, egotism, false equivalence, and sympathy for autocrats is difficult to calculate. But it is clear that the summit in Helsinki was a tragic mistake." The Arizona Republican senator added, "No prior president has ever abased himself more abjectly before a tyrant." Suddenly, the word treason became part of the public debate about Trump. The former CIA director, John Brennan, called Trump's comments nothing short of treasonous. A dam had broken. After consulting with Sanders and other aides in his private cabin aboard Air Force One, Trump issued a tweet trying to seal the leak in the dam. "I have great confidence in my intelligence people." But the uproar continued. Even such reliable boosters as the former House Speaker Newt Gingrich, whose wife Callista served as Trump's ambassador to the Vatican, and Brian Kilmeade, a Fox and Friends host, said Trump made an error and should correct his statement. Back at the White House, Trump confided in friends that he did not understand what the big fuss was about. He thought the summit had been an undeniable success. But for the president's aides, a haphazard scramble was underway to blunt the global fallout from Helsinki. This would be a week of corrections and clarifications. At about 8:30 in the morning on July 17th, Trump called counselor Kellyanne Conway, who was at her West Wing desk, and told her to meet him in the private dining room off the Oval Office. The president was upset. He had been watching brutal cable television analysis about his "I don't see any reason why it would be" comment. "That isn't what I said," Trump told Conway. "It is what you said," Conway told him. "I didn't say that," the president insisted. "Why would I say that?" "That's a great question," Conway said. "Why did you say that?" Trump had written down what he meant to say in Helsinki. "I don't see any reason why it wouldn't be Russia." He handed Conway the piece of paper. "I meant to say this," he told her. "Here, go out and tell everybody that this is what I meant to say." "No," Conway said. "I think you should do that. You need to clear that up right away," she added. "That's not just a difference of three letters. That's a difference of intent." Vice President Pence, newly installed communications chief Bill Shine, Kelly, Bolton, Miller, and Sanders soon came into the room to huddle around and help Trump draft a statement to deliver that afternoon, clarifying his Helsinki remarks and addressing the concerns of his intelligence chiefs. Speaking from the cabinet room a day after facing Putin, Trump claimed that when he said, "I don't see any reason why it would be Russia," he meant to say, "I don't see any reason why it wouldn't be Russia." This, the president explained, was sort of a double negative. But on July 18th, at a cabinet meeting, Cecilia Vega of ABC News asked Trump whether he believed the Russians were still targeting the United States. The president responded with just one word, "No," once again contradicting his own intelligence chiefs and his own correction. Sanders later told reporters Trump was not answering Vega's question. He was saying, "No, he's not taking questions." But it was too late. The next day, July 19th, Trump gave Bolton an order: schedule a second summit with Putin and invite the Russian president to visit him in Washington. Bolton sprang into action to make an overture to the Kremlin, and by afternoon, the White House announced that planning was underway for a fall visit. The Putin trip would not end up happening. At this very moment, Coates, the director of national intelligence, was speaking at the Aspen Security Forum. The intelligence chief acknowledged that he wished Trump had made a different statement in Helsinki and that he ought not to have met with Putin alone. Coates also spoke forcefully about the continuing and undeniable threat of Russia's interference in America's elections. When Andrea Mitchell of NBC News asked Coates what he tells intelligence personnel risking their lives in the field when the president disavows their work, as he did in Helsinki, Coates said he tells them, "We are professionals. We are here to provide professional service to our government. We need to keep our heads down. We need to go forward with the wonderful technological capabilities that we have to produce intelligence. There is a lot of swirl, political swirl, going around. Just do your jobs. Coates's candor was remarkable, considering some colleagues in national security circles gave him the nickname Marcel Marceau, after the French mime, because he was typically so tight-lipped and rarely opined freely. Before opening the floor for audience questions, Mitchell made an announcement. We have some breaking news. The White House has announced on Twitter that Vladimir Putin is coming to the White House in the fall.
Say that again?
Coates said, leaning forward in his chair. Vladimir Putin coming to, Mitchell replied.
I hear you, Coates said,
cupping his hand to his ear playfully. They both laughed uncomfortably. It was obvious that this was the first Coates had heard of the Putin invitation. He took a deep breath.
Okay,
Coates said, chuckling. With a wry smile, he added,
that's going to be special.